Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, May 25th. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Steve.
And from WCAI, our reporter, Sarah Tan. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve.
And we'll be speaking later in the program with Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll check in with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, Brittany Bowker at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and we'll speak with Andy Tumbalonis at SouthCoastToday.com. Now, a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the Islands. Big story out this week is about the state naming Vineyard Wind to sell offshore wind energy to Massachusetts Electric Utilities. Paves the way for the creation of the nation's largest offshore wind farm right here off our coast. Patrick, Cape Cod Times had a lot of coverage on this. Sarah Tan, our reporter, also following this. Sarah, let me start with you. There were three companies vying for this contract.
Yeah, there were three companies. There was a company called Bay State Wind, which is associated with Ørsted, which is a Danish company. There was Deepwater Wind, and there was a company called Vineyard Wind, which ultimately won the contract.
And Patrick, you had in your article, you were looking at some of the criteria that they used to evaluate this decision. You want to talk about that?
Sure, but they don't necessarily want to talk about all that criteria. They were talking about basically price, and that's what Vineyard Wind's executives were saying they thought they won out on. They said, we think we had the lowest price. That number is not available to us at this point. They say that as part of the process where they go with this power purchase agreement that they'd negotiate with the three utilities in the state, that that number would come out. It did in Cape Wind's case, if everybody will cast back that far, where the DPU was analyzing things. The AG came in. They did some analysis, and eventually out of all that, I think I remember doing the math, as bad as I am at math, and trying to figure out what the actual cost per kilowatt hour for you and me and the consumers out there is. So that was one of the things that they looked at. They also looked at other factors, including kind of the project's ability to foster employment, economic development in the state, and the environmental impacts, as well as the extent that the project demonstrates it avoids basically effects on natural resources and tourism, which, again, these were all things that have come up in the past as people have been talking about offshore wind.
I guess there was, going into the announcement, there was still a big question about whether it was going to be one company, two companies, maybe even three. At one point, it was a suggestion, but they were looking to sign off on 800 megawatts of electricity, the state looking to get these purchase agreements into place. And it turned out to be just one company. Do you have a sense of how much of a surprise that was, or how much, Sarah, how much, what the reaction was on that?
Yeah, I think there was a lot of surprise across all boards. I spoke with the mayor of New Bedford, John Mitchell. He said that, you know, they're very pleased with the decision, but they had been, I guess there had been some talk that they thought the state would go with at least two companies, just in case one company's plans fell through, there would be something else to fall back on. So it really shows a large commitment on the state, and, you know, they seem to really trust that Vineyard Wind is going to come through on this.
And we should mention, too, that one of the other companies there, Deepwater Wind, actually did get a contract, but not through the state.
Well, and they are looking essentially to negotiate a contract with Rhode Island, with another state. They had come forward with their proposal for Massachusetts, but in this process, apparently Massachusetts and Rhode Island got together and talked this through a little bit and talked with, obviously, the utilities and the companies about this. It's interesting to me because I remember going way back, Massachusetts and Rhode Island basically being in a horse race to see who was going to be first mover in the industry, and they did things differently as far as planning. Massachusetts kind of used the data they had as they were planning. Rhode Island went out and collected fresh data, and they were kind of a friendly competition, if you will, in terms of who was going to get it first. Obviously, Deepwater Wind has some turbines off Block Island in Rhode Island, but in this case, it seems like Rhode Island came in and said, well, we'll take Deepwater Wind on for a larger discussion about another contract, and I think up to 400 megawatts is what they're talking about in terms of that. So it's really 1,200 megawatts basically in this same leasing area in federal waters, but that would be distributed through a couple of states, Massachusetts and Rhode Island.
So Rhode Island does have the first offshore wind farm in the United States. It's just five turbines. Sarah, you were actually out there on Monday of this week to look at these turbines, sort of in advance of this announcement. I'm kind of jealous. I'd like to go out and see these wind turbines. Tell us what it's like to approach a wind turbine on the water like that.
It's really incredible. You know, they're very striking out there. The water, I went out on a very calm day, but you could definitely see how there could be a lot of wind energy out there. The waves are pretty choppy going out. I went out with a number of Chamber of Commerce people. A bunch of them got a little seasick. But it is incredible to stand underneath them. You can kind of feel the force of the wind. Kind of sounds a little bit like an airplane passing overhead when you're directly underneath them. It's not very loud, but you can definitely feel the pressure of the wind as it kind of pushes on you.
And how tall are they?
So I guess it depends where you're measuring from, but for what you're looking for, I guess from the where they hit the sea to the hub, which is where the blade attaches, they're about the height of a 30-story building. And then the blades are 200 feet long, so if you're going from bottom to blade, that's like,
that's
600 feet.
It's 600 feet foot structure out there in the water. There's five of them in this wind farm you visited. What we're looking at here in this potentially could be as many as 100 wind farms in this new area that was just the announcement was made just this week. So.
Yeah, 100 wind turbines in Vineyard Winds area is what they're talking about, 50 to 100. So then Deepwater Winds area, I think, would have more turbines. I think they're talking about quite a number. And the interesting thing is this, you know, industry has progressed. The turbines have gotten larger, and that means you maybe don't need as many. It used to be, you know, 3.6 megawatts was the standard. Now they're 5, and now they're talking about 10. And I think in Europe, you know, they're looking at 10 megawatts. As kind of the gold standard going forward. So as the industry has progressed, they've been able to build bigger turbines. You don't need as many turbines to produce the same amount of energy, obviously.
I want to turn to Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant news out this week. Pilgrim is scheduled to be shut down in another year in May of 2019. An advisory panel is creating recommendations for this process. Sarah, you were at a meeting last week where this was announced. Patrick, maybe first you can fill us in a little background about the advisory panel and remind people what this is about.
Sure. The advisory panel was put together specifically to look at decommissioning. They're a group of citizens, state officials, some, you know, folks from different towns and places that have an interest in what happens there in Plymouth with Pilgrim when it shuts down in May of 2019. And so they've been working, having meetings. Going back to their first meeting a year or so ago, it was a rough start. They didn't seem to really kind of understand the process or have a good handle on what the process was going to look like going forward. But they did, you know, get running, and it also has members of Entergy, the company that owns Pilgrim, on board. So its purpose was to prepare for decommissioning and to figure out what's going to come next after decommissioning starts to occur, and kind of that's what these recommendations have to do with.
So the recommendations, Sarah, can you give us a sense of what they are and what we're looking at?
Yeah, you know, the recommendations are kind of just a culmination of what this group has been talking about for the past year. And so they are things like that Entergy is going to have to keep someone on board to kind of oversee the decommissioning, and that environmental groups are going to have to continue to collaborate to find what is the best solution. And, you know, community groups are going to have to be involved in it. Just kind of things that seem obvious, but they've put it into writing finally.
And but the sense from the panel was, as they made these recommendations or they voted these draft recommendations, was that it's significant, right?
Yeah, this is historic for Massachusetts. I guess Sean Mullen, the chair, said that this was a milestone in decommissioning nuclear power plants. Right now, there are no regulations. There is nothing that says you have to have an interagency organization that oversees the decommissioning. And so in many ways, this is something that Massachusetts is forging ahead on.
And this touches on the next story, another story that came out this week, which was really about the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that oversees this, the federal agency that oversees nuclear power plants, wanting to codify how plants are decommissioned. It turns out that they don't have a lot of regulations in place already for decommissioning plants. Plants are getting older, and we're seeing a lot more start to move into a decommissioning process, Pilgrim being the one right here. What did we hear from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission on this?
Well, and these are obviously connected, but just to go backwards for a second, the one proposal that didn't get unanimous support in those recommendations mm-hmm. was one where the folks on the advisory commission wanted to be able to enact regulations about radiological and environmental standards, and Entergy kind of said, we don't want to do that. Why do you need that? We've closed plants before. We didn't need new laws to do that. So just having said that, looking at these new rules that NRC is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is looking at, they're basically saying we need to streamline some of these exemptions that plants like Pilgrim always come to us with. And as they're decommissioning, they're saying we don't really need so many regulations around security. Mm. We don't really need so many regulations around this or that, because they're saying, well, the fuel isn't, you know, actively being used. It's cooling down. There's not as much concern about safety and those things, at least from the industry's standpoint. Obviously, activists look at it differently and say, we really do need to keep watching these things. And if you start giving, you know, this blanket exemption is what it really comes down to, you're taking away the teeth if anything's happening and anything's going wrong. So, again, there's this back and forth. The rules, again, that they're looking to change would basically take all these little exemptions that are asked and given along the way and basically codify them into something that's more broad-based in terms of a larger exemption.
Let's speak with Sarah Brown, who's on the phone right now from the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Sarah, the Vineyard Wind story has, not surprisingly, a vineyard angle. The company has partnered on the island. It's pledged some investments. You're the closest landfall, I guess. So what does this story look like from Martha's Vineyard?
Yeah, as you said, there's definitely, first and foremost, a geographical connection with the wind lease area being directly south of the vineyard, about 15 miles south. And so the Vineyard Wind name certainly is true as far as being near the vineyard and affecting the vineyard. But because the bid award went to Vineyard Wind, there's also a direct vineyard connection. Vineyard Wind is owned by these two companies, Avangrid Renewables and a Danish company, Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners. But they have signed a community benefit agreement with Vineyard Power, which is based here on the island. It's a local, you know, sustainable energy, renewable energy co-op. And there's really the Vineyard Power has been a part of the work negotiating and working out how this wind farm would unfold. And Vineyard Wind has proposed a pretty big investment in the island economy, has talked about a $10 million investment, including building an operations and maintenance center that they're tentatively planning for the Vineyard Haven waterfront. They said they would employ up to 40 people there. And they've also said there will be workforce training program at the high school here, as well as, you know, at the college level courses and local community colleges to train people for offshore wind energy jobs. So that's another investment they've said that they'll make in the local economy. And it sounds like from what officials said this week that these local island benefits, you know, working with this community, were a big plus for the Vineyard Wind project. And, you know, beyond that, too, it also, the State Secretary of Energy, Matt Beaton, said this week, you know, that this award and this project really puts Martha's Vineyard back in the spotlight, as it's been before, for being environmentally conscious and kind of leading the way in creating clean energy. So there's definitely that. It looks like this could be become a part of the island economy as this goes forward.
Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. Sarah, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Patrick Cassidy. Sarah Tan, thank you for joining us this morning. We're going to go to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. And with us on the phone right now is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, you've got a fascinating story about a coastal house that's in jeopardy and a novel plan to save it, something that may become a model for other sites if it works, maybe. Tell us about this.
Maybe, yes. That's a good caveat there. But the property we're talking about is at 498 Shore Road, which is just north of the Chatham Fish Pier. And it has about 108 foot of frontage along Chatham Harbor, and there's a steep coastal bank between the house and the harbor. That has been eroding for quite some time, and it kind of took a bit of a beating during this past winter, like a lot of shorefront banks in the area. Now, way back in September 2004, the Conservation Commission approved a rock revetment to protect this property, which is valued at about $3.9 million. But the decision was overturned by the State Department of Environmental Protection because the house that sits on this property was built in 1986. And under the State Wetlands Act, revetments are only allowed to protect homes built after 1978. Which is when that law went into effect. Now, after several years of appeals and lawsuits, some of which are still pending, the property owners they worked with some coastal engineers and they came up with this plan, which they're calling a living shoreline. Now, apparently, these type of structures are used quite a bit in the Mid-Atlantic area, but they're pretty new to Massachusetts. And what it is basically is. They're hoping to recreate a marsh that once existed along the beach at the base of the coastal bank. Now, engineers, they've created marshes in other locations, including here in Chatham. The difference here is that this is a much more dynamic area because the harbor is the currents are pretty swift and it is subject to a lot of coastal storm action during nor'easters. What they're proposing to do is plant beach grass and other vegetation in this sort of mixture of compost and sand, which is all encased in organic fiber rolls, which are then anchored into the beach with 8x12-inch cobblestones. Now, this idea, the engineers say, the cobbles will basically hold the structure in place to keep the elevation of the beach stable while the vegetation establishes itself. And over time, they say that this could form into a peat bank. And, it can take decades for a peat bank to form naturally. So they're hoping that this will be sort of an accelerated process. Mm-hmm. Now, more fiber rolls will be used above this on the bank to sort of keep that stable. And there'll be extensive monitoring and sediment replenishment when it's needed. Now, state officials say that they don't consider this a coastal engineering structure like a revetment, so they're allowing it on this property, like I said, a post-1978 home. And Conservation Commission members in Chatham were pretty receptive to the idea, although they said, this is going to require a lot of monitoring, and specifically if it fails, they want it removed because there's concern that the rocks that they're using, even though they're small, could if they get spread out into the harbor, they could damage some of the resources there. But both the town and the state are saying that they're looking at this closely as possibly, as you said, Steve, a model for protection of coastal areas where there are post-78 homes that are threatened by erosion, either on the Cape or elsewhere in the state. So the Conservation Commission, they haven't officially approved it yet, but they're expected to do that within the next couple weeks. And then we'll hear if the state has anything further to say about it.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Steve. Take care.
Patrick Cassidy of the Cape Cod Times. A report out once again cites concerns over drinking water as a result of contamination coming out of Joint Base Cape Cod.
Yeah, and this came up in, I believe, a meeting with the town of Falmouth. Essentially, Joint Base Cape Cod is included on this national list of military installations where there's contamination from PFAS and PFOA. I get my PFOA and PFAS is all mixed up. But in any case, these are contaminants of concern that a lot of people are talking about. They essentially come from firefighting foam that's used since 1970. A lot of it's still around, honestly, in fire departments. But it's kind of no longer the thing to use these days because of these concerns over contamination. On the base, it was used in various ways. They had a kind of a firefighting training area where it was used. And there were also a couple of tankers that rolled over in the area or around the base that they had to fight the fires on, I think a couple decades ago at this point. But all of that kind of seeps into the ground. And the base, which has always had issues with the use of munitions and the contamination from that, says they're looking at this, they're on top of it, and they're basically doing a lot of testing. And they found in public and private wells off base that they were finding that the levels of this contaminant were exceeding the kind of EPA's recommended level of 70 parts per trillion. And so they're continuing to test these areas in and around the base and trying to figure out exactly how to handle it. They already have two programs up and running that are addressing contamination coming from the base, these plumes that have been talked about for quite a long time now. And there's some progress being made on those fronts with other contaminants, but they're taking kind of a fresh look at this and trying to figure out what to do with it. And again, this is being talked about everywhere. In Barnstable, they're talking about this. The town of Barnstable is dealing with it from the firefighting academy there. It's being talked about around the country and obviously on military bases where these foams were used.
Patrick, a story out this morning, State Senate has passed an amendment folded into the budget bill that could nullify an agreement that the Barnstable County Sheriff has with federal immigration officials.
Yeah, and I believe the amendment was passed late on Wednesday night.
Okay.
It was an amendment to, again, this budget bill. It was from Senator Jamie Eldridge from Acton. Our state senator, Julian Sear, did vote in favor of it. One of our state senators, Julian Sear, voted in favor of it. Vinny DiMacedo, who represents parts of the Cape as well, voted against it. And this 287G program that the sheriff officially became a part of, the Barnstable County Sheriff and a couple other sheriffs in the state and the state correctional facilities are all a part of. They're the only organizations in New England who are part of this program. Allows them to essentially start the more or less the deportation process when they run into somebody who's coming into their facility, who's here and in the country illegally. And that raised a lot of concerns among activists and among some legislators when it was first announced a year or so ago and late last year when it became official. But nothing was immediately done. This amendment, was passed by the Senate. It still has to go to the House, and there's the sheriff, who our reporter Jeff Spillane spoke to, didn't seem too concerned about it. He looks at the budget process going forward, and I think the House hasn't expressed any appetite in kind of taking this up before the end of the budget season here. And the governor has said that he would veto it, I believe, and he has his own idea for a plan on how to deal with immigration issues, and has put that forward. So it doesn't look like it's going to go anywhere, but it did get enough support in the Senate to pass and certainly raised the issue of and the amendment itself, if it wasn't clear, would do away with that 287G program and not allow it to take place, among other things that that would be more protective of people who are in the country illegally. And so, again, that was something the sheriff didn't look fondly on, and obviously more conservative members of the legislature didn't look fondly on.
I thought it was interesting. There's only three counties in the state that have signed these agreements with federal immigration: Barnstable County, Bristol County, and Plymouth County. So even this amendment really applies to, I mean, anybody else who wanted to get into this, obviously, but these are the three that have already signed these agreements.
Yeah, and as I said, the state correctional, mass correctional department, that's in New England who have signed it. I mean, not only just in the state, but again, obviously Massachusetts, is trying to address this at the Senate level. It's something that, you know, the argument of whether it's a federal issue or a state issue is ongoing. The sheriff says, why would you not have agencies talking? And he referred back to 9/11. Why would you not have agencies talking to law enforcement agencies talking to each other, which is essentially what this would negate, is the sheriff's office speaking with Immigration Customs Enforcement about who they have in their jails.
Let's talk about the town of Falmouth and the saga over its two wind turbines, which is continuing. Cape Cod Times reporting that Wind 1, one of these big turbines, is not going to be relocated within the town.
Yeah, and it would have been hard to believe that they would have ever tried to do that. I'm sure there would have been an uproar among the folks who have been fighting the operation of these turbines and won in court on both turbines, essentially getting them to be shut down. They haven't operated for quite some time now. But the town, having said that they couldn't continue to operate these turbines, and even having said, this is one of those instances where one town department is telling, you know, the selectmen what they have to do, essentially, and that's that they have to take these down at this point. They're considered a nuisance according to a judge's ruling and according to other decisions made within the town. And so they're looking to take down Wind 1, and that's went up in 2010, I believe. And the question is, you know, take it down and do what? They've essentially issued a kind of a draft letter that says we're going to take it down and we're going to basically sell it, I think is what they're going to do, to somebody else somewhere mm-hmm. else out of town, maybe even out of the state. And essentially they just want to get rid of it, maybe get as much money as they can for it. But that's the process they're going forward with at this point for Wind 1. They still have to address Wind 2, which is the other turbine. And there was some question about what to do with that as well.
So Wind 2 still out there wondering what's going to happen with that. Town of Mashpee, the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe, have come together on some language to amend a bill that's in the U.S. Congress and Senate, which is intended to end some legal challenges to the tribe's status.
Yeah, this is essentially Congress stepping in and saying that they're going to make sure that the tribe has their land in trust, which part of which would be used for a casino, which is where they ran into the most problems with neighbors suing and beating them back at the federal level and the Interior Department essentially saying that their decision to take land into trust, or a judge saying the Interior Department's decision to take land into trust wasn't good enough. So in any case, Representative Bill Keating, who represents the Cape and Islands, came forward with this legislation. The town at the time when he came forward with this a month or so ago said, what are you talking about? You never came to us. You never talked to us about this. How could you be moving forward with this? And how will this affect our agreement with the tribe, which has been in place since 2008? After a lot of back and forth and some contentious letters back and forth between the tribe and the town and Keating's office, it seems that they've come to an agreement. The town has announced that they will support the legislation. There's going to be some tweaking that kind of solidifies that 2008 agreement between the tribe and the town. And it looks like the legislation has the blessing of the town, which maybe wasn't necessary, but certainly can help when you're looking at federal legislation, having everybody who's involved sign off on it.
Let's speak right now with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Casey.
Morning, Steve. How you doing?
Doing well. Casey, electric bicycles are coming to Provincetown in a big way, it sounds like, but also sounds like they're raising a lot of questions for people.
Yes, that's right. So electric bikes seem like the perfect thing for Provincetown. They are, especially these particular kind called Urbies. They're very small. They weigh less than a baby stroller. And you can park them anywhere. You can even bring them into a restaurant. And according to the owners of Coast Provincetown, who are going to be renting these bikes out this year, you can take them on an airplane. So it's interesting. But they are a very new device, and the town officials were pretty, I think, surprised to find that they had that this company, Coast Provincetown, had started a business without going through any regulation, without the regulatory procedure. And Coast Provincetown says they don't need to go through the regulatory procedure because they're an e-business. Yet the town disagrees. The town also isn't sure what to classify them as. Coast Provincetown and also two other bike rental companies which are offering these for rental and sale in one case. Have a different sort of electric bike that has a battery charger on it, but it's also a pedal assist, so you can do both. Anyway, they are all saying that, no, these are really bicycles, and the town is saying, I'm not so sure, these might be two-wheeled motorized vehicles, which then fall into a bylaw prohibition that most was written basically for mopeds.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not mopeds. They're not regular bicycles. What are they? That's the broad question. And the selectmen are going to hold a traffic hearing on June 11th to try to create some regulations to allow these things or possibly not. One of the biggest points of contention seems to be that the town says these cannot be parked in a bike rack. And so they would have to be parked on a legal car parking space, which is obviously not going to work out very well for anybody. So anyway, so it seems like there's a lot of pro and cons. These are great, and some of the guy who's been renting a pedal assist bike said last year he had a family come in, and one of the members of the family had a physical disability, but she was able to use a pedal assist bike and ride with her family. On the other hand, not all bike rental owners agree that this should be allowed and are angry that businesses have seemingly gone around the town's regulations and created something that doesn't make it a very level playing field for the companies that feel that they've complied with the town's regulations. So, there'll definitely be more stories about these motorized, whatever you call them, devices.
Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner. Casey, thank you for joining us this morning.
Okay, thank you.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Brittany Bowker at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Patrick, some numbers out related to the opioid epidemic in the state in Barnstable County. Barnstable County drug overdoses down, but activity of concern is high. In fact, the rate of activity of concern appears to be twice as high as in any other county in the state.
And, of course, you'd have me talk about this right after Casey Myers was on the phone, who knows this issue better than anybody in the state, probably. The activity of concern that you're talking about is about prescribing. And what it is they look at people who basically receive prescriptions from four or more providers that are filled at four or more pharmacies within a three-month period. And they say that that's somebody who may be shopping around, essentially, mm-hmm. to get prescriptions. It's not necessarily saying that the people in Barnstable County are doing that. There's a lot of caveats with this. But when we looked at these numbers, again, the drug overdose deaths were down 5% in the first 3 months, as you said. Fentanyl continues to be an issue and has been found in 85% of these overdose deaths. So that continues to be an issue. But the thing that jumped out at us was that, again, as you said, Barnstable County, compared to all the other counties, has basically twice the rate of this activity of concern that they're talking about. Our reporter Tanner Stenning talked to experts, obviously, to kind of get their sense of this. And they did say there were some caveats. Obviously, we have a population that's older and may be in need of prescriptions, and that may be one reason why they're out there getting more prescriptions, and some of that may play out within this activity of concern category. And the other thing that they say is the prescription monitoring program may be just working better. It may be one of those things where the baseline wasn't there, and now that the prescription monitoring program is in place, you see this kind of jump up. Mm. But it was interesting that I think the jump also occurred within Barnstable County in terms of it kind of doubling in activity of concern. And they were looking at the prescription monitoring program, as I said, working. It might be the reason for that. But it's obviously something that they want to keep an eye on. And this whole thing kind of started with prescriptions in a lot of ways, and people getting overprescribed, and then that leading to, you know, addiction on pills and then heroin and fentanyl and the whole nine yards. So certainly keeping an eye on prescriptions and who's getting those prescriptions and who's getting maybe more prescriptions is something that they're worried about.
And it may be that the drop in overdose deaths is related in part to access to Naloxone, overdose reversal drug.
Yeah, everybody, you kind of Naloxone, Narcan, by its brand name. In a lot of respects, people say that there are people who are, again, not dying because they have this overdose reversal drug in place, and that may be helping with the overdose deaths. Overdoses themselves may not be coming down at the same rate, obviously. But there is some cause for, progress thinking progress has been made. Again, you keep somebody alive. There's an ongoing debate about you keep somebody alive. Maybe there's a chance that they get off drugs. Mm-hmm. Other people say you keep them alive, they're just going to go right back out. And there's some discussion within the state about having doctors be able to keep patients who come in as overdose patients in the hospital for a certain period of time as a way to address that, them going back mm-hmm. out and overdosing right away. So a lot of moving parts, a lot of legislation at the state and federal level trying to address this.
We're going to speak now with Brittany Bowker at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, Brittany.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm well. Brittany, Islanders turned out for a talk on ticks. Education is a big part of prevention in dealing with tick-borne illnesses. Tell us, what did people hear?
Yeah, so Sam Telford, who's kind of become the island's tick specialist, he's a professor of infectious disease at Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine. He came to the island Tuesday to talk to a group at the Vineyard Haven Library. And the biggest takeaway from his talk was to look out for Rocky Mountain spotted fever, which he believes is the worst tick-borne pathogen you can get. And it comes from the dog tick, so it's different from the deer tick where Lyme disease comes from. And it's a bacteria that sits in the cells and cuts off oxygen from the capillaries. And in some extreme cases, it can lead to amputation of all four limbs. So it's a really shocking reality that stems from a small tick bite. And then Dick Johnson, who is, he does tick surveillance for the island's boards of health. He was also at the tick talk, and he talked about different preventative measures that islanders can be taking. And he recommended using permethrin, which is an insecticide that can be sprayed on clothing, and it can also be applied to yards to create a tick barrier. He said that it's safe for humans, it's safe for dogs, but it's actually not safe for cats. So if you have a cat, be careful using permethrin. And for direct skin protection, Johnson recommended using DEET. So those are just some preventative measures islanders can be taking as we get into the busy tick season.
Brittany, Memorial Day weekend is upon us. There's been such concern over Steamship Authority ferry issues to Martha's Vineyard. Give us an update on where things stand there.
Yeah, sure. So the Steamship Authority sent out a press release this week saying that they're holding off on all construction at the Woods Hole Terminal until Tuesday, so there shouldn't be any problems with construction. They're insisting that all the boats are running smoothly, so nobody should have any trouble getting over that Vineyard Sound this weekend. And they are also actively seeking out that outside management consultant to perform the overall organization review that was called on last week during the Tuesday summit, where everybody unanimously decided that an outside management consultant should be hired to review the Steamship Authority. So they're actively seeking out that third-party consultant.
Brittany Bowker, Martha's Vineyard Times. Brittany, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, the Cape and Islands District Attorney's Office will be holding an ethical training seminar. This kind of comes out of a story that we've talked about here a number of times of an assistant DA getting into trouble for abusing her position.
Yeah, the Board of Bar Overseers basically came out a week ago and recommended that Assistant District Attorney Laura Michard be suspended. That still has to go to the Supreme Judicial Court to be, you know, decided on officially. But obviously, one of the other recommendations that came out of that was that she take an ethical class before she's allowed to return to work. The District Attorney Michael O'Keefe has apparently decided that everybody in his office should take some ethical training, and he's going to hold this training in June, and it's going to look at, you know, a lot of things that have to do with, you know, ethics and being a prosecutor. He said, you know, prosecutors, defense attorneys, they all should be looking at this. It's as important as you know, any sort of law training that they do. So they're going to go forward with that, obviously a reaction to that decision from the Board of Bar Overseers.
Andy Tomolonis joining us from SouthCoastToday.com and the New Bedford Standard Times. Good morning, Andy.
Hey, Steve.
Andy, you covered the Vineyard Wind announcement, and you really took it on from the South Coast angle. You've got a lot of good coverage that folks can look at online. You want to touch on that quickly?
Sure. Well, it's a big day in New Bedford. Really, it was a culmination of years of effort, on the parts of people in New Bedford, people at the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center, and others. And there were three companies vying for the right to develop. This will be the nation's first large-scale offshore wind energy installation. There is a small one off Block Island, but this one's located in federal waters about 15 miles south of Martha's Vineyard. And Wednesday, the winning bid was announced, and it went to Vineyard Wind. And now the company's going to move forward with plans to build about 100 turbines in an area that it controls out there. So the state of the art right now and in the near future is an 8-megawatt turbine. That means it's about enough to generate about that much energy. And so for an 800-megawatt installation, you'll need 100 turbines. You know, they may get better as technology improves for 10-megawatt turbines, which would reduce the total number. And that's roughly enough electricity to power 450,000 homes. So there was another award as well in Rhode Island. Rhode Island awarded Deepwater Wind, which is a Rhode Island company, contract to develop 400 megawatts wind energy in an area off Rhode Island. It's a combined Massachusetts and Rhode Island area. So that makes 1,200 megawatts, and that's about enough to power 600,000 homes. So to put that into perspective, when the coal-fired Brayton Point Power Station in Somerset closed, I think that happened right around last year, around Memorial Day, it took away 1,535 megawatts from the grid. So the total wind power doesn't quite replace that. And next year, Pilgrim is going offline. So that I think it's next year or the year after. Pilgrim goes offline soon anyway. And that would remove another 685 megawatts. So, you know, what's next? I think Vineyard Wind now has to negotiate a contract. They have until July 2nd. And then the deal has to be approved by the Department of Public Utilities by end of July. And so the company's going to told us that they're going to continue pursuing permits, they're going to keep surveying the ocean floor and talking to their potential suppliers. Construction could begin by the end of next year. That's 2019.
Pilgrim
Yes, go ahead.
I was just going to say that Pilgrim is going offline, scheduled to go offline end of May 2019, so next year, yes.
Okay, yes, yeah, so it is just about a year from now. And so there are a few reasons why Vineyard Wind won the bid. I think the number one reason that people talked to us was the price. Prices weren't made public when the bid, you know, when the information was released and on Wednesday. But there were other factors, the environmental impact, the experience of the people backing the proposal, and then the construction schedule. So one thing that might have helped Vineyard Wind is that they completed a lot of their preliminary work before the other companies, and they had an earlier timeline, and that would allow them to take advantage of tax credits. So maybe that is how they kept the price down lower. So Vineyard Wind's headquartered in New Bedford, but it's owned by a Danish investment company in called Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners, and also Avangrid Renewables, which is a Connecticut-based company, and the Connecticut-based company is owned by Iberdrola of Spain. So they're a deep-pocketed investors, and even though that's a local company, Vineyard Wind, it's not really local where the money's coming from.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a lot going on in the next couple of months, and we had one of the wind executives tell us New Bedford is going to be a very, very busy place. We have the Marine Commerce Terminal, $113 million structure in New Bedford that was built with the possibility, or actually a very strong likelihood, that it would become a staging area for offshore wind companies. So turbine parts would be shipped in through the hurricane barrier and then some assembled, and then they would be shipped out because it's a very close distance to the areas that are being developed. And there are no tall structures. If you look at some of the other, there are no bridges to go under is one of the big things because, you know, these are huge parts. And, you know, while there are concerns about the hurricane barrier, you know, getting through our hurricane barrier, I think they're building newer ships that will handle that, that narrow opening. But the biggest concern was the height. So you didn't want bridges over the top of where these things were going to be shipped out. So, yes, it's a lot. It's a lot that's going on.
Andy Tomolonis of SouthCoastToday.com, New Bedford Standard Times. You've got plenty of coverage on this. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Yes. Yeah, we do. We have a special wind page called SouthCoastToday.com, Offshore Wind. And so you can find all the stories there.
Thanks, Andy.
Okay.
Patrick Cassidy is with me from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, a story out this week about scientists from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution helping to locate what they call the Holy Grail of shipwrecks. And this actually happened quite a while ago, but the details are only coming out now.
And depending on what you're talking about exactly, it happened a long time ago in 1708 when the San Jose, a Spanish galleon, went down after being battered by a British battleship off the coast of Colombia. So it went down with 600 crew members on board and lots of treasure, gold, silver, and jewels. That's why it's called the Holy Grail of shipwrecks. They're estimating it's billions of dollars worth of treasure at this point in today's dollars. But again, more recently, but still a while ago, November 2015, a group of scientists and marine archaeologists were able to find the San Jose after a bit of searching. Didn't take that much once they were in the area and somebody had done a lot of research for this. But the reason we care about it is because the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution right down the street here was involved, as they often are when you're searching for things deep underwater. It was, I think, 100-square-mile area, which for them is kind of not that big of an area compared to other things that they've done, including looking for, you know, Air France 447 that went down off Brazil in 2011. That was a much larger area that they were looking at then. But in any case, they used Remus, which is one of their robotic devices to robots to go down and find this. They got about 30 feet off the deck, and they were able to see cannons and pottery. Got a little closer, got to see some color, and got to see, interestingly, these dolphins that were engraved on the cannons, I believe. And that's what clued them into the fact that this was, in fact, the San Jose and that they were in the right spot. Not without some controversy. The government of Colombia has been engaged in some legal challenges. There was a firm that said that they had found the ship first. And there's also some concern out of the UN, UNESCO, which deals with education and culture, about the exploitation of the ship for commercial purposes. And those are concerns that are kind of ongoing. But as of right now, it's found. Colombia is kind of dealing with it. Hui may still be involved in some of the analysis going forward. But their big job was to help find it. And there's some incredible pictures of
I was going to say, the pictures are
yeah, when you think
amazing.
Holy Grail, you see this pottery, you really do get a sense that this was pretty incredible. And I'm sure when they did find it, they were all hooting and hollering.
You have a story in the Cape Cod Times this week that I really like. This was about a family scholarship and some students at Dennis Yarmouth Regional High School, and it's a moving story, actually.
It is, and Dennis Yarmouth Regional High School, the district itself, is always kind of in the news for battles over budgets and things of that nature. This was the Reardon family who talked to some staff at the high school and said they wanted to offer high-achieving, low-income students a scholarship and money to further their education to one or two graduating seniors. The school came back to them and said, all right, here's a list of six to choose from, and the family said, you know what, we're not going to choose from these six. They're all great. We're going to give scholarships to all of them, and it amounts to $10,000, I believe, a year for the 4 years that they're in college. And this is a family from East Dennis and live part-time in East Dennis, and they just decided that they wanted to help out. It's interesting to see some of the online comments about this, because you know, I think somebody came in and said, well, why isn't Sandwich doing something like this? And somebody else said, well, Sandwich has, there's things going on in Sandwich too. And then somebody turned it around and said, well, you don't look at it in a bad way. Look at it as an inspiration for different people in different towns to come forward and look at these opportunities to help young people further their education and do something similar. So again, they have to maintain a certain grade point average, 3.0, and give the family a yearly update as to how they're doing in order to maintain the scholarship. But it really was one of those stories that it was really nice to be able to put it on the front page, because it did deserve the limelight.
And even that the family had said they wanted to make this one scholarship. The school rounded up six students who they thought were good enough. Students had written these essays, and it was really the essays, it sounds like from the reporting, that really moved the family to say, you know, we can't just single out one of these kids. We have to why don't we support all of them going forward?
And absolutely. And again, these kids being who they are, they also wrote thank you letters afterwards,
yeah,
of course, to the family. So
I want to touch on one other story. Seven dolphins rescued this week. I guess it happened on Sunday. A volunteer effort really comes together with iFall to make this work, to get these animals back in the water. water quickly.
Obviously, International Fund for Animal Welfare out of Yarmouthport often in response to these strandings. They had help from AmeriCorps, Cape Cod, and National Marine Life Center in responding to this, a team of 30, I believe. The interesting thing is these are Atlantic white-sided dolphins. We're used to common dolphins coming up, so we're not. It's not unusual to see dolphins strand, but they were able to get all these dolphins and put them back into the water at Scusset Beach pretty quickly. They came from Chapin, and it was a successful roundup of the dolphins. You don't always see that.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Patrick Cassidy, from the Cape Cod Times. Thank you, Patrick.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you to all our correspondents. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.